How are you all doing out there? Some thumbs up. Day on a retreat like this is, today's weather is kind of a good mirror or example. We've had a little bit of everything, right? Sometimes the first day of a week-long retreat like this, we might at times be wondering what we were thinking of. Why did we think this was a good idea? Or maybe one of our friends suggested it and we want to strangle them. Or someone said, oh, it'll be great. And we're wondering, clearly they are insane if they thought this was going to be so great. Or maybe we're just so happy and we wonder why we didn't do this years ago and everything in between. We had sun and rain and thunder and lightning and warm, too cool, everything today. Probably by the end of, coming close to the end of a day like this, and you probably noticed we have kind of two big challenges, two big problems in meditation. A body and a mind. That's supposed to get a laugh. I mean, it would be easier because the body, it's not always comfortable, is it? And the mind doesn't do what we want all the time, does it? Maybe, does your mind, you know, like, kind of want it to stay with the breath, and does it do that? No. Sometimes, maybe for some of us, but these things kind of have their own ideas about, the body and the mind have their own ideas about what's going to happen, don't they? I think probably if we took a survey here in the meditation hall and kind of asked everyone, oh, why would you choose to come to a retreat like this? Because it's not a small thing to decide to do. It's not something you do just on a whim or, well, maybe, you know, you think about it, you plan it, you decide you want to do it. It takes a lot, as I was saying last night or whenever, about the decision, the intention to come on retreat and to undertake a meditative practice or something you might call a spiritual life. Maybe those words not exactly meaningful, but something like that. I think we'd find that you know, we all might have our own stories about that, but underneath it, we would say that we're motivated by a desire to find some peace or happiness or ease or contentment. And linked right to that is possibly some sense of not being completely happy or at ease now. There's some connection to stress or struggle, maybe real deep sorrow or suffering in our lives, or a sense that things are just not quite right all the time. The weather's not the way we want it to be all the time in our lives in some way. And we're hoping, oh, we'll find something here that will bring some, address that in some way, this lack of ease, this sense of stress or struggle that comes to us at times. This afternoon in the guided self-compassion, Anne was talking about how things aren't always the way we want them to be. And sometimes it's really hard. And there is stress and struggle and sometimes real suffering. Life isn't always smooth. This quality of dukkha, it's there in our lives. Really woven into the fabric of our lives in a certain way. And it lives at the very heart of the Buddha's teachings. And this concept, this understanding of dukkha, it's very profound and rich and nuanced. the word nuanced something you, what's a good Finnish so translation, anything for nuanced? Subtle.
Yksityiskohtainen, hienovarainen.
Yeah, what she said.
Nuansseja.
Nuansseja.
Yeah.
It's there's a profundity in terms of the depth and breadth of this this insecurity that is the characteristic of dukkha, that is constantly informing our lives. And we don't see it all the time. It's like you could say it's an aspect of the human condition. We don't see it all the time. We don't even maybe recognize it that much. But it has this profound impact in our lives, in the world. And as I said, it goes right to the very core of what the Buddha was pointing at as the understanding the cause of our struggle and stress in our lives and the key to finding freedom from that. You hear me okay in the back? Yeah, okay. And so having a real, not theoretical, but a practical and personally real relationship and understanding to this is really essential for us if we're going to walk this path to any real depth and really plumb the possibilities, take this to the possible depths that the Buddha pointed to as real and there for us as a possibility for all of us. He once said, "I teach one thing only. Now and before, I teach one thing only: suffering and the end of suffering." And this statement, ones like this, have led to a lot of misunderstanding, kind of given Buddhism a bad reputation. You know, people who hear this and hear it in a superficial way said, "Oh, Buddhism, life is suffering. Good luck. Have a nice life." You know, and that's that misses a whole chunk. He didn't say only life is suffering. He didn't say that. He said, "I teach suffering and the end of it." And the end of it sounds kind of good. We might sign up for that. But why do we have to do the suffering part? Let's just go straight to the end of it. But to get to the end of it, we have to understand it in order to release it. We have to understand this, what this dukkha is. I want to read a quotation from a teacher, is a Buddhist monk from the Thai, the tradition of the Thai forest tradition. But he's an American-born man named monk name is Tanisaro, but he goes by Tan Jeff. His name is Jeffrey de Graaf, is a given name when he was born. He says, "No single English word adequately captures the full depth, range, and subtlety of the crucial Pali term dukkha. Many translations have been used, stress, unsatisfactoriness, suffering, and so forth, and each has its merits in a given context. There is value in not letting oneself get too comfortable with any one particular translation of this word, since the entire thrust of the Buddha's practice, of Buddhist practice, is the broadening and deepening of one's understanding of dukkha until its roots are finally exposed and eradicated once and for all." We say the entire thrust of what the Buddha taught is this deepening, broadening and deepening of our understanding of this. That's what Anna was pointing at, that, you know, these different words, because it's very profound and subtle concept. So even though it was talked about, I want to look at it a little more. So, on the most elemental level, it does point to pain, painful, unpleasant feelings in the body, in the mind, as was described earlier today, associated with just having a body and a mind. Birth. The Buddha said, birth is dukkha. Aging and sickness are dukkha. Death is dukkha. There's stress, there's painful, unpleasant feelings associated with these things. Not getting what we like is dukkha. Getting what we don't like. Association with what we love, being parted from what we... Associated with what we don't love, being parted from what we do love. These kinds of things on this level. Problematic mind states, difficult things. So this is one level of it. A lot of what was described earlier today in the guided self-compassion. And you know, we're all familiar with this. This is part of life, isn't it? And then there's this more subtle level, this sense of unsatisfactoriness or unreliability that is directly linked to the nature of things to change. So it's a kind of subtle anxiety that arises in relation to the nature of things to change. So pervades things. So in that case, even pleasant things have the quality of dukkha because they don't last. Not that they're great and they come, but they don't last. So this unreliability or unsatisfactoriness there, because we have a beautiful, maybe we had a sitting where, you know, it was pretty good. The body felt okay for a while. The mind was kind of behaving itself, and we felt at ease for a while. Body relaxed. Maybe even better than just okay. But okay is pretty good, huh? And we finally got it together. And then the next time we come in here, it's just like a mess, a train wreck. This is that unreliability. We can't count on it to stay one way, to be the way we want it. So this unsatisfactory thread, this unreliability of anything that is subject to change to be the thing that provides us with lasting happiness, contentment, satisfaction, fulfillment. It just can't do it. Not because we did something wrong or there's something wrong. It just is the nature of it to pass away and change. Unavoidable truth of the reality of things. It's just, this is the way things are. There's a very, very famous translator of the Buddhist text, the Pali text teacher named Bhikkhu Bodhi. Maybe some of you have heard of him. He's done a lot of great translations of these early Pali texts. He's a very highly practiced and highly studied. He's one of these incredible minds that some people have. And he said that dukkha, this quality of unsatisfactoriness or unreliability, it points to this basic insecurity of the human condition and throws before our awareness, in a way we cannot evade, the vast gulf stretching between our ingrained expectations and the possibilities for their fulfillment in a world never fully susceptible to domination by our will. That's kind of a mouthful. But basically he's saying it just points out over and over we are not in control of having it be a certain way. We have this idea that it should be, and there's this huge chasm between that and what's actually achievable. We don't get to decide, I'm going to only have pleasant feelings in my body and really cool mind states. But we have this idea that we're supposed to be able to. We're maybe hoping that we'll get that from meditation. That's what it's going to give us, is some special, you know, and if you don't get it, it's because we're holding back some secret teaching that will give us this control. Or else we either held it back or we just don't know. Or something like that. We have this idea, and it's promoted in the culture so broadly that we're supposed to be able to get our lives where everything always is the way we want it to be. Always, and we're always happy and full of satisfaction, and it's all good. You know, it's like these TV commercials we see. You know, in the TV commercials, I don't know, I don't watch TV much, but at least the old ones I used to see sometimes, everybody in it just, they're having such a good time, aren't they, with that, the thing they got, their new car or their food or their place they're visiting or having a good time with their friends, and they're so happy. And we're supposed to be like that all the time. And if we're not, it's evidence of personal failure. Somehow we blew it. And so it's not that there's this some, like, this defeated thing that would have to come from this. Like, oh well, might as well just give up. No hope. You know, and we can add things into the mix. We do our best to live with grace and integrity and to guide our lives in a good direction. We do have some agency in this regard, but we're not ultimately in control of things, are we? And we see that in our momentary experience, and we see that in the broad scale of a lifetime. We can't decide not to get old. Or to get sick. And we cannot decide not to die. And that's the trajectory of a life. If we take birth, from that first breath, we are heading towards that last breath. Unavoidable. It's confronting. This is major existential. Okay, given that, you know, death is certain. Death alone is certain. The time of death is not. What am I going to do? It was addressing these fundamental questions or existential dilemmas of aging, sickness, and death that got the Buddha to go on this quest to find understanding. What's the meaning? What's the point if I'm just going to get old, probably sick, and die? What's it all about? There's something to understand about this, to bring meaning to my life in light of these things. And so there's a key understanding that the Buddha came to in this exploration of the human condition, is that stress and suffering related to this unreliability, this unsatisfactoriness, this inability to control things, that stress and struggle, suffering in relation to that, is born in the mind, that that's actually not a given thing. There's some room to maneuver in that. We can't change the truth of we can't make the truth of change go away, but we can work with how we relate to that. That's where we have some possibility. That's the place of freedom. That's the place of suffering and non-suffering. Is in our relationship to reality. One of the things I love about this, the Buddha's teachings and this whole path, is that it is grounded in the truth, in the way things really are. It's not trying to avoid looking at it. So looking at it really directly. Things change. The trajectory of a life is in the direction of a death. And it's it seems so obvious, I think, when we talk about it, at least to me, in my when I hear these kinds of words, it seems so obvious, but then it runs counter to our conditioning, to the usual way we look at things, because we're really conditioned to look outside ourselves for both the source of our struggles and stress and suffering, for the cause of it, and for the solution to it. And so we try to fix it. We try to fix what isn't fixable. And there's a lot of stuff, struggle there. So we try to hold on to it being, it's like, I like it like this. We try to keep that, and it's like trying to hold on to water or sand that slips through our fingers. We can't do it. We try to control the circumstances. And yes, we do what we can, but ultimately it's not subject to our will in this way. And so really getting to the truth of things in terms of this is crucial. If we open skillfully to the truth of this dukkha on this level of this unreliability or unsatisfactoriness, then it totally transforms our approach. We bring the understanding that suffering and non-suffering in relation to that have to do with, they're born in the mind and have to do with how we're relating to this. Then we have the possibility to shift things. That's where the transformation is possible. Is this making some sense so far? Is this language understandable? And so, this is where we start. This is where the Buddha started. It's with this truth. It's the first noble truth. The noble truth of dukkha. It's the very heart of the teaching. I'm going to read a quotation from another teacher in Thailand. He died in the 80s, 1980s. A very famous teacher named Ajahn Chah. Maybe some of you have heard of Ajahn Chah. He said, there are two kinds of suffering. The suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you are not willing to face the second kind of suffering, you will surely continue to experience the first. So he's basically saying, if you're not willing to look at dukkha, to open to it and understand it, to find the suffering that leads to the end of suffering, you're just going to be spinning on the wheel of suffering that leads to more suffering. And that's the rolling on of samsara, you could say, and use this language. And that's been rolling on for a long, long time. So until we open to this, we're going to be looking for a way out. And turning to that which by its very nature is incapable of bringing us lasting happiness. And it's an endless search. It's this rolling on of this wheel. And so skillfully opening to this actually is, it seems like bad news, but it actually is great news, because it leads us to look, okay, I need to look for some way to relate to this that is going to not lead to more suffering for me. And so since the key to happiness and freedom is right within our own mind and heart, there's a possibility for a radical transformation here. So the Buddha and his followers, they weren't known as the bummed out ones, the life is suffering, good luck, bummed out ones. They were known as the happy ones. They were known as happy beings, right? That's where we're going here. It's hard to talk about dukkha and sort of keep this heading in a good direction here. That's the path is heading towards the deepest kind of happiness, towards peace, towards a kind of happiness or peace that is not dependent on the outer circumstances of our life, but it's a deep internal kind of contentment. Something that can weather the changes. Good day, I'm okay. Bad day, I'm okay. That kind of deep peace that can ride the changes of a life, because the changes are going to come. There's no way around those. So when the Buddha made that statement, I teach one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering, he was pointing to this key that opens the door to this understanding. To realize the end of suffering, we have to understand it. We have to understand the causes of it, so that we can let those causes go. That's the key here. And I think everything the Buddha said, and in a way anything that any one of us will say up here, is pointing back to this. Understanding what is struggle and stress, what is its cause, and let me release that cause. This isn't about, you know, we're still going to have painful feelings. The Buddha had plenty of painful feelings and bad days, and you know, he had chronic back pain. He had a lot of people who were trying to, his cousin was trying to kill him, take over the leading of his disciples. People tried to make up lies about him, and he had all kinds of problems in this way. And he got old and sick and he died. But there was his relationship to all that. He had good days too, right? we get it all. We get the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And the Buddha had them too. But struggle and stress in relation to that was different. That's the possibility there. There's an interesting linking that happens in the teachings that's made between opening to this understanding of dukkha and the arising of confidence, faith, trust in the mind and the heart. And I think it's not a real obvious link. I'm going to talk about it a little bit, because you might think, well, why would opening in this way lead to the heart, lifting the heart up with this confidence, this kind of trust, or what's called saddha in Pali. It usually gets translated as faith. That's a little bit difficult translation, because for some who have been raised in other traditions, faith means something very specific in terms of a kind of, maybe a kind of surrender, and also a kind of, it's tied up with a certain kind of belief. And it means something different. So confidence or trust are probably better translations for the word saddha. One of the founders of the Insight Meditation Society, a teacher of mine, and a colleague also of mine these days at times, is named Sharon Salzberg. You may have heard of her. She's teaches a lot about loving kindness, metta, and the other Brahma Viharas. And she equates this quality of sadha, of confidence or trust, as finding a safe place where you can rest your heart, rest the mind and heart. It's very much like, in my mind, the sense of finding a refuge, a safety, a place of safety, of ease, and a place we can rest, really rest, like a safe harbor in a storm. And finding something like that, this place where we can really feel a deep ease, no matter what's going on in life, is like, it opens the mind to a kind of, opens the space of the mind and heart. And it lets us really ride the changes that life brings. This inevitable movement from happiness to sadness, from pleasure to pain, from joy to sorrow, and so forth. These worldly conditions, these worldly winds that blow through a life all the time. It lets us find an ease with that, a non-struggle with the truth of that, and touching this a deep, radical kind of happiness, a kind of contentment. Ajahn Chah once said, I'm quoting him a bit tonight, he said, in this practice, in Dhamma practice, we begin with the truth of dukkha, this pervasive unsatisfactoriness of existence. But as soon as we open to the experience, this experience, we lose heart. We don't want to look at it. Dukkha is really the truth. If we allow ourselves to face it, then we will start to seek a way out of it. If we are trying to go somewhere and the road is blocked, we will seek a path around that. We will look for an alternative route. So there's the suggestion here that rather than fighting against the truth of things, we shift our approach and look for a different way. So rather than trying to control what isn't controllable, or going into a place of defeat and because the road is blocked and we're just giving up, we look for some other way. Let go of fighting against reality, you could say. Seek another way. So, opening in this way is the start, but it's not enough. We need to also find something that gives us a sense of possibility. So again, from the teacher Bhikkhu Bodhi, who I quoted earlier, he said, for faith to arise, two conditions are needed. The first is the awareness of suffering, which makes us recognize the need for a path of freedom, path of liberation. And the second is some kind of teaching that points to a possibility that seems real to us. So we need these two things. Something that we can draw on for some strength and courage, something that seems trustworthy. A path to walk, you could say. There's a story from India, not too long after the time of the Buddha, so from quite a long time ago. There was a king in India, his name was Ashoka. And he ruled almost all of India. It's a pretty big area. It was bigger then because you had to walk or ride a horse everywhere. It felt larger. From around 268 to 232 BCE. So that's about around, 300 years, 250 years after the Buddha died. And it's said that in his early years of his, he was very aggressive. He pursued the expansion of his kingdom. He was said to be very greedy, really driven by wanting more, and kind of bloodthirsty in his approach to getting that. So he started a lot of wars to conquer kingdoms, to expand his power base, his realm. And he was also said to have been very, very unhappy. And it's said that after one particularly bloody battle that he had started in trying to conquer some other kingdom, that he surveyed this, it was in an area called Kalinga. There's some historical specificity, it was in this place this happened. He was, you know, maybe on a hill or something, surveying this the battleground and seeing all this carnage, all the deaths there and the destruction. And it's said that there was a Buddhist monk who was walking through this area. And this monk had this sense of, this aura of peace and serenity. And it really struck him. He seemed to radiate this peacefulness. And it's not that the monk was unaffected by what was around him. He was aware of that. But he had this, that he wasn't feeling anything. He wasn't closed down. He had this serene, but he embodied and seemed to project these qualities of a kind of deep equanimity and a deep kind of peacefulness. Seeing that things happen out of conditions, and when there's a bloodthirsty guy in charge, this kind of stuff happens. So it was a deep kind of wisdom and acceptance of the truth of things, and this peacefulness that was there in this being. And Ashoka was really struck by this. He wondered, how could this be possible? This monk is walking along. He doesn't have anything but one set of robes and a bowl to collect alms food. Depends on people to put something in the bowl every day to be able to eat it all. He doesn't have anything. He seems happy, and I have everything. I've been working really hard to get everything, and I'm not happy. What's going on here? So he was touching into some connection. He was opening maybe to the truth of dukkha. All this getting isn't doing it. I just have to keep getting more. It's insatiable. Maybe there's something else that this monk is pointing to just by his very being. And so he followed this guy and asked him about this. And the monk gave him some teachings about meditation and about what the Buddha taught. And Ashoka became a follower of this tradition. And it transformed his life. It said that after this, he became very kind and a just ruler. There's remnants of his time and power even to today. There are these. Have any of you been to India? Some of you may have gone. Did you ever see an Ashoka pillar there? There are these stone pillars that are. There's still a few of them, and they have a lion. The lion that's symbol that's on the Indian flag is drawn from this. And these are, you know, 2,300 years old, some of them made of stone, and they were set up all around. And he dug wells, provided water along paths and roadways, and he planted trees and started hospitals. He prohibited animal sacrifice. He said that's not going to, you know, this belief that you had to kill animals and offer their blood to have things go. And he said, no, we need to stop doing this. He did all kinds of, he practiced religious tolerance, so he didn't demand that everybody had to be a Buddhist or anything else. He let people believe what was meaningful for them. And it all came, so he turned into a pretty good time in India. More closer to a golden age in a lot of ways, in terms of having a ruler who seemed to really care about people and beings and do good things for them. It'd be great to have someone like that in my country. We have someone who is maybe a little more like Ashoka was before, deeply confused about what would bring happiness. Really deeply confused. Wants to be happy just like any of us. Has no idea what might bring that. So this monk wasn't trying to convert this guy. He was just walking along, trying to get to where he needed to go. But this expression of this non-ordinary kind of happiness that was there had this profound effect, transformed this king and transformed the country, and pointing to this possibility of a different way and of something that we might think of as a place of true refuge. So this kind of peace and wholeness woven into the fabric of one's being that is not so susceptible to the changes in a lifetime. And in the case of this monk, not only was it his inner experience, but it projected out into the world and was like a gift. This gift that then changed everything in that part of the world for that time. Quite incredible when you think of that. Someone walking along in the right way at the right time, and what flowed on from that. And the Buddha was always pointing to this kind of deep peace, contentment, as a possibility for us all. And this practice in mindfulness has the potential to open us to this. It's the key that unlocks the door that leads to this kind of contentment and peace and deep happiness. You can look in your own mind and heart right now and ask the question, is there awareness here in this moment? As I was saying, I think I said, you get to say yes when you ask that question, don't you? And it seems so simple and not like a big deal, but it changes everything. This allows us to actually connect with reality, to see clearly, to understand suffering and what and its causes, and to find a way to let those go, to release them. And so this quality of a certain kind of confidence that may not come easy, but we start to touch into it through connecting with this quality of mindfulness right in every moment. And it's said that the mind today in the guided self-compassion, Anna talked about the wings of the Dhamma as the wings of wisdom and compassion. And said that these are cultivated, that they grow within us, that they become fulfilled one moment at a time, like one drop in a bucket that we're filling with water. Every moment of mindfulness, another drop in those buckets. It does take a certain kind of confidence to just put those drops in, because we might not see how full the bucket. We can't see into the bucket. It's like a big ceramic urn with a narrow neck. We can't see. It's going to feel the same putting those drops in, whether it's a little puddle in the bottom of it or it's getting really full. And our job is to put those in, and that's really all we can do. We can't will ourselves to freedom or make it a choice, but we can put those drops in. And in that moment, we can find a kind of peace and contentment that is radically different. And I remember noticing this at times when it struck me, because there was nothing in my usual way of looking things that would indicate that I would be so contented. I remember, I don't know if I told you, but I started meditating at a time when my life opened up, and I could really kind of dive into this, the meditation, and I went to a 10-day retreat never having meditated at all. Not even for a second. That was kind of intense. But by the end of it, I wanted more, and I heard about this 3-month retreat, and so I decided I would go there, but I had to do another retreat to qualify to get in. So I did that, and then I went to this 3-month retreat within 6 months of ever meditating at all. And so I was basically, I'm still kind of a beginner, but I was really a beginner then. And yet I remember at one time I was just sitting somewhere. It was in between formal practices. I was just sitting mindfully, and I felt this incredible contentment in my mind that I think I had never experienced before. And it wasn't because of anything except that I was living with this kind of care and attention and presence. Just the mindfulness. There was this contentment just because of that. This possibility to live that carefully. I remember that's what I loved the most, that I could live that carefully. And I was really struck, why am I so content now? Or another time struck by this, I was in India and I was in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha is said to have been enlightened. I'm going to run over just a little bit here. And I was on retreat at this, at the Thai temple. And there was a 3-week retreat, meditation retreat, that was being taught there. And I was staying in this basement underneath. Did you ever go there? Underneath the main temple building, there was this place that you couldn't stand up straight because the ceiling was too low. And they put all the men to sleep down there. And so we were just one next to the other on these straw pallets on the floor. It's a little more comfortable here at the Friendship Inn. We had a mosquito net. It was like, you know, these mats. And there we were, and it was pretty far from any toilets, so we had these 5-gallon buckets to urinate in at night. And someone, me, had the job of carrying out the buckets of urine to dump them. Somehow that was my job. And I was walking along, sloshing in these buckets full of urine on my way to the bathroom one morning. And you know, it's hard to stay healthy in India. I probably was a little bit sick. And I was so happy. And okay, this is evidence that I am insane or something. I have some deep problems here. But I just noticed I was so contented. And granted, I knew that was not, I didn't have to spend the rest of my life doing that. But my feeling at the time was that if that was the rest of my life, that was okay. That was okay. And it was just because I was, had this awareness and this connection to reality. And so why would I, that's not the usual job description for, you know, urine carrier. Apply here. Do I see it, Lana? No pay, bad food, and uncomfortable lodging. Do y'all want to apply for that job? Sounds like a bad deal. But so I'm telling this story not because you should all run out and do that, right? But this possibility of this contentment wasn't because of what was going on at all. It wasn't because of the outer circumstances. It was this inner possibility there. Many other times that I've been struck in this way in my life. So this possibility of this radical kind of contentment, a kind of independence, really, not a disconnection. I was not disconnected from reality. I was really in it. But in a way, in a balanced kind of way. So this is possible because it's born of the angle of our vision. It's born inside the mind and heart. It's not coming in from the outside. We can rest in the truth of things in life's changes and find peace right in there. So this is a place of refuge that we find in our own mind and heart. That's what the Buddha was pointing to. And this quality of mindfulness, of awareness, is the key that leads to that possibility, that opens us to the truth of things. So I offer this for your reflection this evening. And we can, I'll stop talking and we'll just sit quietly for just a minute and let the words drift away. You don't have to shift your posture. It's fine how it is.